to the January edition of the Cell Press podcast. This month, we saw massive numbers of women turn out for the Women's March on Washington, and in this podcast, we too are turning the spotlight on women in our first two pieces. First up, a look at mother-daughter family dynamics in orca whales, and what this tells us about menopause. Second, a discussion about HIV acquisition in women, and what we're learning about how the vaginal microbiome influences that. Also, we have trans editor Rebecca Schwartzlose with us today to talk about the science of writing a review that others will actually want to read. All this and more is ahead, so stay tuned. Believe it or not, menopause is actually a surprisingly rare phenomenon. Besides humans, orca whales are one of only two other species that experience it. Why is this? Good question, and one that researchers have been very curious about. This month, researchers writing in Current Biology have some fascinating answers. Dr. Darren Croft from the University of Exeter shares what his team is learning about menopause in orcas and what mother-daughter relationships might have to do with it.
Darren, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Most of us understand menopause in reference to humans. Is the process and timing similar in the orcas?
In the orcas, the females are having their last calf in their 30s to 40s, but potentially living till they're 80 or 90 years old. So it is quite similar, the timing of this across the lifespan.
That's really interesting. So along the same lines, do orcas live in family groups like we do, or are they more solitary?
Well, when we say orcas, we just need to clarify what type of orca we're talking about here, because there are different ecotypes of orca. And here we're talking about the resident killer whales, the fish-eating killer whales off the coast of Canada, BC and Washington. These are the resident whales, and they're unusual in mammals because neither son nor daughters disperse from the family group. So they live with their mother her entire life, and that is very, very unusual. There are only a handful of mammals that do this, and they're all tooth whales, as far as we know.
So these older female whales who undergo menopause still stay in the family for a long time then?
They stay in the family until they die, and the important thing is that their sons and daughters stay with her entire life. But the key thing here is that when those individuals mate, when they breed with individuals from different family groups. So they're not breeding within the family. They mate with individuals from different groups, but they live in this very tight, cohesive family unit where there's no dispersal by either sex.
Interesting. What are the older female orcas bringing to the table? Why are they hanging around?
We know that these old females play a really important role in helping their pod, or rather helping their matriline to survive. We've shown that they increase the survival, even the survival of their adult offspring. And one of the ways they do this is by sharing knowledge of when and where to find food. And the other way is actually by feeding. They catch salmon and feed their adult offspring. So we've shown that they benefit their group in late life, but that can't explain why they stop reproducing.
This is unusual that they undergo menopause, and your study wanted to look at sort of what the impact was of the menopause and why this might be happening. So how did you go about studying it?
One hypothesis is it's actually about competition and conflict within the family group. And it's about old and young females competing to reproduce at the same time. And actually, for reasons of local relatedness and the structure of these groups, younger females are fighting harder for limited resources and older females are investing more in their group. We tested this using this long-term demographic data by looking at what happens to the survival of calves when calves are born to old and young mothers from the same family. So a daughter gives birth at the same time as her mother or within a short time window. What happens to the survival of those calves over the first 15 years? And we found that when that happens, the calves of the old mothers, the mortality risk is almost twice as high over their first 15 years as that of the calves of young mothers. And what's really important here is that it's not just old mothers or worse mothers. If we look over all of the data, there's no difference in calf survival between old and young mothers. It's only when they enter into this competition over reproduction that the old mothers lose out.
So it ends up being in the group's best interest for the older females to stop reproducing.
It's a combination of these older females gaining the benefits from late life helping, but then there are other examples of long-lived social mammals where we know grandmothers have played an important role in elephant societies, for example. We know that these old matriarchs also store knowledge of when and where to find food and how to respond to predators, but that they don't go through menopause, that they continue breeding until the end of life, continue reproducing until the end of life. So it really is about this tug of war over resources by the old and young mothers. And in the killer whales, the thing that's different about the killer whales to the elephant case is that the younger mothers are on average less related to their local group, and the older mothers are more related. And that difference in relatedness leads to a difference in how those females should behave and how hard they should compete for those limited resources.
Yeah, it sounds like from what you're saying, one of the key differences is that the sons stay with the killer whales in their group, but in elephants, the sons go off. So that the overall genetic relatedness differs.
Absolutely. You've really captured it there. It's driven by the patterns of dispersal and mating. And so another really interesting thing about these resident killer whales is actually because the males mate with females from a different group, if a son reproduces, then the calf is reared by another family group. It's not reared within the son's family. So there's no cost, really, to the local group of sons reproducing, whereas if a daughter reproduces, the calf is another mouth to feed, and that increases competition within the group. And so females, old post-reproductive females, invest more in their sons and helping their sons than they do their daughters.
Oh, interesting. So bringing this back to humans, given that menopause is so rare and we are one of the few species that we know of that undergoes menopause, do you think that it evolved for similar reasons, that maybe back when humans were living more tightly clustered together that we might have seen some of this competition?
One of the difficulty with looking at humans is that we can't really look back at those ancestral societies. But from what we know about primates and the evidence, it does suggest that actually the structure of those social groups were very similar in the change in relatedness with age, so that the younger females in a group were less related to their group than the older females. And that's because the evidence suggests there was a bias towards female dispersal. And so the similarity in the social dynamics and how that changes across the lifespan in humans and killer whales suggests that very similar processes may explain the evolution of menopause in both species. In the killer whales, we can really test the generality of the theory that's been developed to explain menopause in humans. And indeed, probably the only data set, the only non-human mammal that we're able to do that in is this unique data set for these two populations.
Interesting. Trying to imagine a killer whale undergoing hot flashes. I guess maybe if you have the nice cold ocean around you, it's not so bad.
So our data is restricted to the demography, and we don't know, you know, what the individuals experience in terms of the physiological changes. But we do know that they really do stop midway through life. They really do terminate their reproductive activity, which is just incredible.
Yeah, it's fascinating that the timeline is really so similar to humans. The whole study is really interesting. You've done some terrific work here.
Fantastic. Well, I'm really pleased to hear that.
But thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today.
Wow. Over 40 years of data collected on this group of orcas. It's quite impressive, really. Did I understand this right? The whale data suggests that the same kind of competition once existed for human mothers and daughters, too?
Yeah, that seems to be the case. This is the issue, right? We can't go back, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years and study what was happening with human mothers and daughters or proto-human mothers and daughters. But the whale data, because we can study it over multiple generations, gives us a way to test some of the theory. So this is actually using whales to test a theory about humans. And it does suggest that the same kind of competition for resources may have influenced the evolution of menopause in humans as well.
Next up, we'll be talking HIV and what makes some women more susceptible to infection than others. Stay with us. In this month's issue of Immunity, researchers published some new findings on HIV acquisition in women, specifically in a group of young South African women. There are many factors that can influence your odds of contracting HIV. But for most of us, when we think of the factors that influence our HIV risk, our microbiomes probably don't make that list. But as we're about to hear, maybe they should. Ben Tolkien talks with Dr. Douglas Kwan about our evolving understanding of how the vaginal microbiome biologically predisposes some women to acquiring HIV, and most importantly, what we might be able to do about that. Ben?
I'm here with Doug Kwan of the Ragon Institute at Mass General Hospital, who's been investigating the role of the vaginal microbiome in HIV acquisition. So what did you do in this study?
Our lab studies mucosal immunology and HIV infection, and we've been studying a group of young women who were living in a region of sub-Saharan Africa, just outside of Durban, South Africa, in which there were just very high community HIV incidence and prevalence rates. We were trying to understand what factors might influence their risk beyond just exposure, what biological factors, specifically within the female genital tract, because most HIV is transmitted through heterosexual sex, so over 90%. There have now been over 900 women in this study, and one of the things I love about this study is that they don't just come in and as part of the research give samples, but they actually come twice a week. They're involved in a poverty alleviation program, so there's a huge investment in the participants. Along with that, we also do biological sampling, where they give blood and samples from the genital tract periodically, and then we sort of follow them. Each time they come to the clinic, they get an HIV test, and so we're able to determine very early on who acquires HIV and who doesn't. We started these studies wondering if the microbes that normally live within the genital tract might actually change a woman's risk of acquiring HIV. And in this study, we found that, first of all, that the baseline community structures of the vaginal microbiome in this community were very different than those that had been described sort of in white women living in developed countries. If you look at white women, most of them have a healthy microbiome that's defined as one particular type of bacteria, Lactobacillus or Lactobacillus crispatus. And that's sort of what we think of as healthy. But in this group of young, healthy South African women, most of them didn't have the quote-unquote healthy community. So less than 10% had Lactobacillus crispatus, whereas 60 to 70% had much more diverse communities with Lactobacillus abundance. And what we found is that those women with the more diverse communities were actually acquiring HIV at over fourfold higher rates than those women who had Lactobacillus crispatus communities. And that was independent of any kind of sexual behavior, you know, contraception use or other sort of known HIV risk factors. We think that these more diverse communities actually have specific bacterial components that are sensed by the host immune system locally within the genital tract that induce inflammation. And with that inflammation is an increased number of activated CD4 T cells in the genital tract. Now, CD4 T cells in the genital tract are part of immune response, but in the case of HIV, they're particularly interesting because those are also the first cells to be infected by HIV. So whereas you might think, oh, having more immune activation before you get exposed to a pathogen might be good because there might be more soldiers to fight that potential invader. With HIV, it's a little bit different because HIV actually infects those immune cells. Part of the mechanism is that when women are exposed, if they have more of these activated target cells, they're essentially more fuel for the fire.
How could understanding this effect on HIV be important in the future?
You know, what we believe is that the microbiome in the genital tract might be leveraged then to decrease acquisition risk in women, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where these more diverse communities are more prominent. The question is, how do you actually do that? And so that's a big focus of some of our next steps. Sort of what is causing these women to have these more diverse communities? Can they be manipulated to shift them towards more optimal communities that have more lactobacillus? And can that be done in a way that is persistent? Probably antibiotics alone may not be so effective. We know that women who have a clinical disease called bacterial vaginosis, which also has these very diverse communities, if you give them antibiotics, that most of them actually clear when they have antibiotics, but then they just recur soon after stopping antibiotics. So there clearly are more complex mechanisms to maintain these communities. They seem to be relatively stable. It's not going to be a simple intervention like just giving one dose of antibiotics that's going to lead to a persistent change in those communities. It's going to take more understanding and deeper understanding of how those communities are regulated to really create persistent changes. But that's something that we're very interested in exploring. The other thing that we're really interested in is sort of understanding, will changes in the microbiome affect not just biological risk of acquiring HIV, but the efficacy of certain prevention measures that are being developed or have been developed? Certainly, it may help you identify women who are biologically more likely to acquire HIV. So then if you can find populations that are at greater risk, then you might then try to target them to be more aggressive with prevention measures to reduce their risk of acquiring HIV. I think another thing that our study shows is that what we think of as a normal microbiome is really geography specific.
So what are your hopes for the future of understanding and treating HIV in South Africa?
If you think about what are the methods that we have to prevent HIV infection, things like using condoms, having male circumcision, getting tested, being monogamous, starting antiretroviral therapy, if you are positive, I think in the social context of many of these relationships that some of the young women are in within sub-Saharan Africa, many of those measures are controlled by their male partners. There is this very involved poverty alleviation program that the participants are engaged in. And despite that 6 hours of class a week, twice a week for a year, one of the really frustrating things as a clinician to me was that we aren't able to reduce their rates of acquiring HIV. It's not just about education or access to condoms or even access to, you know, existing pre-exposure prophylaxis methods, that a lot of the acquisition, at least within this community, is driven by factors that aren't easily changed just by very intensive poverty alleviation program. So for me, as a scientist, that really sort of drives me to try to figure out, okay, well, what can we do biologically to better understand why these women are acquiring HIV and how to reduce their risk? These women are just young, healthy women between the ages of 18 and 23 who just live in this community in which there are very high HIV incidence and prevalence rates. Many of these women are in relationships in which they're dependent upon their male partners who are, you know, exposing them, many of whom are exposing them to HIV. But for some of these young women, poverty is a much more immediate threat than acquiring HIV. So if they don't have any other means to sort of provide food or housing for themselves or sometimes a young child, then they live with the reality that they may actually acquire HIV from their male partners. There's very little that they can do about that. It makes it difficult for some young women to really control their own risk of HIV. For me, that means that we really need to help create more biological understanding of HIV acquisition in women to sort of create better measures that women can control to reduce HIV themselves.
This is such an important topic. Ben, what stood out to you the most about the study?
I think science often seems very far from the people it's ultimately going to affect. And in this study, they took a really holistic approach to not just doing research on these women, but involving them in an education program and having the research be guided by the realities of their situation on the ground.
Next, stay with us. Our own Laura Shefsack chats with reviews expert Rebecca Schwartzlose. How do you write a review that will catch your reader's eye? Rebecca has the inside scoop just ahead. The Trends editors eat, sleep, and breathe reviews, by which we mean they commission, read, and edit them, a lot of them. What we're trying to say is, when it comes to reviews, they're the experts. Rebecca Schwartzlose, editor of Trends in Cognitive Sciences, shared her review writing tips with us on Crosstalk last month. And lucky for us, she's here today to share her advice in person.
Hi, Becca.
Hi, Lara. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here because, you know, this post that you wrote for Crosstalk, it shot straight to the top of our most viewed posts, which is kind of amazing because it's only been out a few weeks. And so it really has resonated with a lot of people, and I think we should talk about it.
Great. Yeah. It's been fun to see the response. Heard from a lot of people that they enjoyed it, and that's been very gratifying.
The thing that is kind of curious to me, so there are a lot of reviews out there. We publish a lot. Other journals publish a lot. People read a lot of them. People write a lot of them. Why write this post now? Like, what made you want to do it?
I've been wanting to do it for a while now. It's just finding time to do it. I mean, for me, I live reviews, right? I spend a lot of my time thinking and reading reviews. I managed to carve out some time to write up some of my thoughts about it, things that have just kind of accumulated in my brain over time from that experience.
And one of the things that struck me about it, you place an early emphasis on the value of a review for curation. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think that sometimes we think of a review as sort of covering a topic. You take a general area and you're going to tell everything that one wants to say about that topic. But really what we need out of a review as readers, as a scientific community, is some sort of clarity, some sort of synthesis. I study brains, or this is my background is brains. So for any brain, you're going to be overwhelmed if you have a glut of related facts. What you really need is something that is distilled, that is telling you something that you can then move forward upon and act upon in your own research. So I do think that a lot of what the reviewer brings to it is an eye to what in this vast literature that they're covering is important, what is meaningful, what is it telling us, and that's something that I think it makes reviews invaluable.
Mm-hmm. And I think that framework giving people a way to think about a body of literature, I couldn't agree with you more. You phrase it in your piece about understanding why you're writing. How many reviews do you see where people really don't understand why they're writing it, based on how it's you're perceiving it?
I think that certainly, I think to varying degrees, authors can struggle with the focus. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you can see in published reviews in various journals. And also, you know, I see it in my reviewer comments or my own experience reading the kind of initial versions of reviews, is that they tend to be less focused. And often some of the work of revising a review is to bring that review into focus, to really kind of take out, you know, what doesn't need to be there and focus on what is really the core message of the review.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the ways that you help authors to get this focus and build this framework.
The services that I provide are vary depending on the manuscript and kind of what's needed from my perspective. But I work with authors to try to, sometimes we reorganize the review so that if it seems as if the order is kind of causing the reader to lose their direction, then we can rearrange it. I sometimes work with authors to help them distill or say, is this section necessary? Is this maybe going to be distracting the reader rather than helping them understand the underlying ideas that you really want to get across?
And that's sort of when they've gone through and done the really hard work of pulling together the information that they want to cover. Do you ever kind of intervene or guide authors way back before they ever start that, at the idea stage?
I do commission reviews, so I do talk to them at the idea stage. Usually, I mean, I'm commissioning reviews from experts in the field, so they're already familiar with the literature. That doesn't mean that they won't then dig deeper on the particular topic, but I'm usually not guiding them at the research stage. But sometimes I do give feedback on like an outline stage. Mm-hmm. I talk about the outline in the article, and I think it's a really important stage. It's a great opportunity for an author to really formulate what they're going to talk about and where they're going, and it's a great opportunity for others to give feedback about the framing and the scope of the article. So I find that is a very helpful stage to discuss with authors as well.
One of the things I like about the piece is you really make a point of saying that once you've written it, you should give yourself a pat on the back. Which is a really important step I don't know that authors take, but the thinking doesn't end there, right? Mm-hmm. Because then you're getting editor feedback, you're getting peer feedback. That process, I would expect, could be different if they followed all your tips. So how would you compare and contrast two experiences for someone who thinks about writing a review in the way you've described versus someone who maybe doesn't?
Yeah, I would hope that it would make the experience more pleasant, the peer review process. I think that in some ways it could introduce mild challenges, because what I've encouraged the author to do is to write for a novice reader. And hopefully reviewers and editors can understand why that's an incredibly valuable thing to do. But of course, you all know that sometimes reviewers can come in with their own way of what they are looking for in a piece. Mm-hmm. And for reviews, that can be very subjective. So they can come in and say, well, you should mention this caveat and that caveat, mm-hmm. and get into details that will be unhelpful, I think, for the review. And so if that happens, that's a situation that then, you know, it stands to the other reviewers, to the editor, to the author to kind of overcome. But hopefully, I think, and I do think that most readers, most reviewers recognize the value of accessibility. Mm-hmm. And so even if they aren't an expert in the field, if they can see something that's well written and that can bring something that they're passionate about to a broader audience, they want to get on board. They're mm-hmm. excited about that.
Mm-hmm. And so that's maybe what you mean by a more pleasant experience.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, hopefully that then means that, you know, what you as an author sat down and spent all that time trying to bring across comes across early on to the reviewers, and then you don't, you know, you can get a more positive response from them and from the editor, but and also a swifter process with less revisions necessary.
Yeah. And since, you know, the reviewers are the surrogate for the reader, it's a pretty good indication of how your piece is going to be received.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I'm thrilled that you wrote this, because I'm expecting the quality of our reviews to just skyrocket as people read it. In fact, what I'm going to do is start sending the link to this post to people that I commission from.
Oh, thank you. That's lovely.
Yeah, I think it's great. So thanks for coming and talking about it.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Good.
And if you haven't checked it out yet, now seems as good a time as any to point you in the direction of the new CellPress Reviews portal. Browse around, read some reviews, and let us know what you think. Next, we have more from Lara as she brings us the news roundup, all this month's highlights from around Cell Press.
First up, researchers reporting in Cell have isolated two groups of brain neurons responsible for predatory hunting in mice. By selectively stimulating these neurons with lasers, the researchers could get mice to pursue and bite just about anything in their path, including non-food items such as sticks and bottles. We turn the laser on, and they jump on an object, hold it with their paws, and intensively bite it as if they were trying to capture and kill it, says lead investigator Ivan de Araujo from Yale University. The system in question is not one of generalized aggression, however. The neurons seem to be specifically related to the animal's interest in finding food. Furthermore, de Araujo and his team found that one group of neurons controlled pursuit, while another group controlled the kill. Animals without functional kill-controlling neurons would pursue prey, but could not deliver the fatal bite. The team is now exploring the sensory input into the amygdala to determine what triggers predatory behaviors, and is investigating how the two types of neurons, control and kill, are coordinated. Next up, researchers reporting in Stem Cell Reports have moved us closer to being able to restore vision in patients with end-stage retinal degeneration, a leading cause of vision loss and blindness in older individuals. Typically, patients with conditions such as retinitis pigmentosa and age-related macular degeneration lose vision as a result of damage to the outer nuclear layer of light-sensitive cells in the eye. There is no cure for end-stage retinal degeneration, and currently available therapies are limited in their ability to stop the progression of vision loss. Now, researchers from the Riken Center for Developmental Biology have successfully reprogrammed skin cells from mice to an embryonic stem cell-like state and converted them to retinal tissue. When transplanted into mice with end-stage retinal degeneration, the converted retinal tissue developed into photoreceptors that established direct contact with neighboring cells in the retina. The new tissue restored vision in nearly half of mice receiving transplants. The authors hope to proceed to clinical trials in humans after some additional studies. Finally, have you ever imagined what the world must look like to hummingbirds as they zoom about at speeds up to 60 miles per hour? According to new evidence reported in Current Biology, you can't. That's because a key area of the hummingbird's brain processes motion in a unique and unexpected way. In all four-limbed vertebrates studied to date, most of the motion-detecting neurons in the brain are tuned to detect motion from behind, such as would occur just before a collision or a predator attack. However, researchers from the University of British Columbia found that almost every neuron in the analogous brain area in hummingbirds was tuned to a different direction. In other words, the birds don't specialize in front-to-back motion. The researchers also found that these neurons were most responsive to very fast motion rather than to slow motion as they had expected. Through future work, the researchers hope to get a better understanding of how neural activity in the hummingbird brain is translated into specific flight behaviors.
This brings us to the end of this month's podcast. Thanks for joining us. You can listen to this and previous Cell Press podcasts at our archives or by using iTunes. And be sure to come back next month for more great science from around Cell Press.